I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. It's nice to be back with another live stream. If you would like to send your questions, your comments, and your donations, you can do that by looking at the banner at the bottom of the screen. It says go to entropystream.live/countercurrents. Hit the green button. You can leave a question, a comment, and a super chat. And we would very much appreciate it. It helps us keep the lights on. It helps us pay the bills. Also, you can send your DLive tokens because we are streaming still on DLive. Those add up. Last year, DLive tokens added up to $2,500, which is almost 1% of our annual fundraising goal. So I appreciate them. They seem trivial, but they do add up. So send them along. Also, if you are on Odyssey and you'd like to send a tip, you can send tips through Odyssey as well. I want to welcome two guests tonight. The first I announced a little bit earlier, it's Pox Populi. Pox, welcome back.
Thank you for having me on again. It's a pleasure.
And the other is something of a surprise, last-minute guest. He wasn't sure he could make it, so I didn't want to announce too far in advance. Morgoth, welcome back.
Hello again. I have to apologize to everybody. I'm pretty under the weather with a chest and throat infection, but like a good trooper, I'm gonna soldier on and make the best of things.
So we were talking before the show, and we started sounding like a bunch of old people complaining about ailments. I'm jet lagged. Morgoth has a chest cold. Pox is coming down with something too. And we might just have a low energy stream, at least in the presentation, but in the content, in the substance, it's going to be extremely, extremely important. So stick with us, folks. We are going to talk first about a topic that I kind of puzzled by. There's a debate going on, sniping going on back and forth in the white nationalist sphere, for lack of a better term, about capitalism and socialism. For instance, there's a group, Howe and Martinez and Thuletide, who are campaigning against the communists and Marxists, represented by, I guess, people like Keith Woods and Joel Davis and others, people associated with the NJP, that kind of thing. And I noticed that Morgoth was commenting on this, wondering what's going on here. Pox was scratching his head about this. I'm kind of scratching my head about it. Is it either capitalism or communism, or is there perhaps a third position here? And if there is a third position, and if most racial nationalists, national populists are in a third position anyway, then what's motivating this debate? And maybe it just should end. I don't know of any laissez-faire capitalists who are also racial nationalists, because nationalists believe in borders, and they believe that borders can trump capital, can trump trade, can trump the free movement of people. We don't believe in libertarian stuff. And I don't know any racial nationalist types who believe in full-on communism or socialism. I think pretty much everybody that I've ever had a serious conversation with about economic matters within our sphere, within our broader movement, basically believes in some form of mixed economy or some form of third position, not state ownership of the means of production, not laissez-faire capitalism, but the regulation of economic activity for the common good of society. So I'm just kind of wondering about this debate. Where is it coming from? Where is it going to? What's it motivated by? And maybe we can get beyond this. Maybe we can stop the infighting. So Morgoth, do you have any thoughts about this? I thought you had a very good Telegram post about it, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to get this whole thing going, this whole discussion going.
Yeah, I don't. It's strange because you get on each side. I'm not sure where the center of alignment is between the sort of the two camps, because I find myself on this issue. I think this relates to something, a rare reply I did to Thuletide a week or two back, where I can't remember even the context of it, but basically my point was that capital will seek to expand itself. It will seek to abolish borders, and it will seek to undermine traditional mores in order to make a profit. And the first thing, like what I think sort of got me about this is where when somebody make these critiques of capitalism, there's a faction where you will immediately be named as a Marxist or a socialist. And that's kind of irritating because there's been, if you go back and sort of the right wing thinkers, you know, some of the big names, there's been a nationalist far right, if that's what you want to call it, critique of capital for at least 100 years, if not longer. And so this idea where we just say, if you put some of the blame for the current situation on capital, wait a minute, what? Okay, sorry about that. I just think that this is not a new thing. It's not a new thing for people on in nationalism to have severe criticisms of capital. But at the same time, you also get this kind of worship of an authoritarian state at the other side. And that it seems to be like it's kind of confusing because I'm thinking, well, this used to be a settled issue. The British Nationalist Party, whatever criticism you want to have for it, the British Nationalist Party's economics were pretty sound. And it was kind of common sense. It was basically close the borders, Britain comes first, British industry comes first, and we don't allow the free flow of capital from elsewhere to undermine the nation state. I thought this was a sort of, I thought this was kind of a done issue. I thought it was put to bed long ago in our circles.
Absolutely. What are your thoughts, Pox?
Well, I think this is, it's become such a big question, a big issue, because the infighting, if you want to call it that, goes back now quite a few years. I think this really kicked off during the COVID years of lockdown and things like that. And you started to have a faction of people who were more or less celebrating the based state wielding power. And they were kind of, I suppose not kind of, they were quite explicitly mocking, you know, boomer schizos who were objecting to things like lockdowns and vaccine and mask mandates and things like that. And so you had this question of, oh, you had these factions of, you know, the state and its power. And this is great. The Chinese model is great. If only Western countries followed it too. And then you had the other faction of people saying, no, Western style individual liberty is actually good in this case. And it's just been going on and on ever since. And yeah, I'm bemused just as Morgoth is, because there is a century at least of nationalist, socialist, literally nationalist, socialist economic theory and socio-political theory. And so it is a bit strange sometimes to see one of those factions will say things like, you know, the typical line, like socialism has never worked anywhere. And I can see why that would annoy other people who certainly are, if they're not Marxists, you know, if they're not Marxist communists, you know, they're at least third positionists, as you mentioned, you know, the people who support a third position. I'll try and give benefit of the doubt to all sides here. And then what happens too is that, you know, you mentioned Keith Woods and Joel Davis. Now, I don't follow Joel Davis too much, or Keith Woods for that matter. Occasionally, I think Keith Woods does very good stuff and has very good ideas. And some other times I find him a bit annoying, but that can be said about anyone, I suppose. But I saw a while ago that Joel Davis did sort of like a deep dive or a breakdown of Marxism. And I think what their main concern is, if I'm being charitable, I think their main concern is that they want to detach Marxism from knee-jerk, boomer-esque reactions to it. And they want to analyze it and see if there's any merit, if there is any legitimacy to its criticism, to the criticisms it laid on, you know, socio-economic policy at its time, in its context. And then I think there's another side that, like the Thule-tide side, that once they hear anyone sympathizing with Marxism, it becomes like a big red flag. And so what happens with online communication is that everyone just builds strawmans, or they do the, So what you're saying is, you know, willful misrepresentation. There might have been some merit to a certain element of Marxist theory in its time. And the response is, so what you're saying is you're a literal Marxist. And then, you know, it's all just fireworks from there. I don't tend to get personally invested in this debate too much. It strikes me as curious that there is so much passion in this, because I thought that we were more or less a movement concerned with a third position who did understand the benefits of a mixed economy, who was, you know, mature enough to make criticisms of capitalism and embrace parts of socialism that are useful, especially with regard to the well-being of a nation. So I think what happened is that also the people on like the Thule Tide, Martinez side of things, they might also feel a bit defensive because many times American-style capitalism, American-style, Anglo-style liberalism is targeted for blame. And I think they are defensive about this. They don't like to see that that the fingers are being pointed at that. And they would like to go back further and say, actually, no, the real blame lies with Marxism and communism and the degeneracy that comes from them and the Frankfurt School and things like that. So I think that plays into it as well. But like I said, I think it's kind of a fruitless debate. I thought we had a different position entirely. So yeah, it is a curious thing to observe.
I do observe in more normie debates online the same sort of straw manning. So you get people who are on the right and they'll look at the Democratic Party and rail at them as literally communism. And you look at people on the left who will rail against people in the Republican Party as if they are libertarians or laissez-faire capitalists, things like that. And it's perverse and wrong and strawmanny, basically. It is strawmanning. Neither one of them embraces the views that they are accused of by their enemies, or that they accuse and their enemies don't embrace the views they're accused of. We're dealing here with people who believe in different degrees of the mixed economy, and yet they, for whatever reason, want to frame this in terms of the battle between laissez-faire capitalism and literal communism, on the other hand. I think a lot of this is sort of clumsy and in bad faith. And it's motivated by underlying partisan divides and grievances. And I think that what you mentioned about the COVID debate, which not coincidentally involved the same camps of people going back and forth, has a lot to do with this. I think that you've got parties here with pre-existing grievances, chips on their shoulders regarding one another, and to keep the battle going, basically, to keep the infighting going, they are now seizing on this kind of strawmanning, mainstream kind of argument, mode of argumentation that I think we all should be beyond. Even the mainstream is really beyond the capitalism versus socialism thing, even though they're constantly accusing one another of these very sins. And we third positionists, we should be really beyond this. And yet, I think we find that because of pre-existing grievances and a desire to just keep the pot boiling, people are now scrounging around for other reasons to attack these camps. And in effect, what they're doing is seizing on straw men. Morgoth, do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, I was just looking at the chat, and there's somebody called Wizard in the chat saying that the third position is basically socialism. It actually isn't. I mean, you can look at, say, fascist Italy, or you can look at National Socialist Germany. It wasn't actually, the people were still getting rich. But the difference is there will be a clearly defined interest of the nation and the people and the health of the people and the state will actually have the final say. So if corporation is promoting something which goes against those interests, it will be blocked by the power of the state. And they may also be coerced into going along with programs of the state which benefit the nation as a whole. But this is not to say that everybody's going to be lining up for potatoes and everybody's going to be having Bolsheviks kick their door down and make them, because that would be antithetical to the principle in the first place. So if you're going to say that, the idea that the state, which represents the will of the people and has the interests of the people as its core principle, let's say, that's how it defines what's good and bad, then if that is wrong, if that is socialism, how do you then, let's say you have a multinational and they are lobbying for feminism, let's say, get women out of the home and get them into the workplace, which did crash birth rates, you are going to have some kind of state legislation which says, no, first of all, the women aren't going out of the home to work in your slave camps, your factories, and we're going to have policies in place to make that this isn't going to fly, because this is detrimental to the health of the people. The people's interest comes before this profit motive. That's what we're getting at. Now, if that is socialism, what do you have in place to prevent that happening? Because presumably you don't want multinationals or corporations flexing with their money to start and break apart society and the traditional family and borders and ethnic makeup of countries in order to garner a profit. You're going to have something you're going to have something to stop that from happening. And if you're calling that socialism and that's something which you can't stand on, I don't know how you're going to prevent this from happening. Happening again, because we can clearly see that it already has happened once.
That's well said. Pox, what are your thoughts?
Okay, well, I think, yeah, that Morgoth is getting really close to the crux of it, which is that people tend to have these knee-jerk reactions to the word socialism. And I just figured that it might be useful to hear what some of the, you know, the founding fathers, as it were, of these ideas had to say. So I'm going to quote an Austrian painter, if that's okay. This Austrian painter, he gave a speech in December of 1938 about this. And he said that, quote, "A socialist is one who serves the common good without giving up his individuality or personality, or the product of his personal efficiency. Our adopted term, socialist, has nothing to do with Marxian socialism. Marxism is anti-property. True socialism is not. Marxism places no value on the individual, or individual effort, or efficiency. True socialism values the individual and encourages him in individual efficiency. At the same time, holding that his interests as an individual must be in consonance with those of the community. All great inventions, discoveries, and achievements were first the product of an individual brain. It is charged against me that I am against property, that I am an atheist. Both charges are false." End quote. So I think it's good to remember that, you know, socialism isn't the great evil that I think, and I think this gets to also one of the motivations behind this, you know, this feud. It's not the great evil that, you know, a Fox News pundit would have it be, right? And so when someone says socialism is evil, it's never worked on our side of things, when someone on our side of things says that, I think it's to be expected that people are going to pile on that person for having that sort of Fox News pundit take. And so then it's just bad news from there. Things deteriorate and the sniping begins. I don't get too personally invested one way or the other. I've often said that when it comes to things like the economy, I'm happy to defer to people with much more intelligence when it comes to these issues. I've read two books, I think, that kind of informed my views on this question, and that was The Unnecessary War and A History of Central Banking. And in both of those books, both authors make a pretty good case that the nationalist socialist policies in 1930s Germany were successful. I'm not as much of a fan of perhaps, you know, Italian-style fascism, but Mussolini did some great things too in that economic system. And so, yeah, it is a bit strange, again, to see like the squabbling over these terms and the revulsion that some people have to them. I suppose people on the other side think that aren't we beyond that now? So yeah, it's an interesting question. I just always, fall back on that G.K. Chesterton quote where he said that he's in favor of any economic system that allows a man to meet a woman, fall in love with her, marry her, buy a patch of land, grow some cabbage on that land, and live out the rest of his life in relative peace and harmony. And I'm opposed to any system that would prevent him from doing that. And I think that's kind of the core of what the Austrian painter was saying in that quote as well, is that the difference is that, and as Morgoth was saying too, in the third position, the well-being of the nation is at the core of everything. Whereas in a laissez-faire capitalist society, I don't think we can always say that, which is, I think, it's an important observation to make.
One thing I think is very interesting about that quote is that half of it sounds like Ayn Rand. Half of it sounds like Ayn Rand going on about the importance of the individual and how every invention, every bit of progress that we can point to is the product of individual minds and oftentimes people going against the grain of public opinion. And yet, by the same token, we recognize that as wide a space of individual freedom and creativity as we wish to create, it still has to be harmonized with the common good of society. That's something, of course, Rand would never say. And simply that proviso, that caveat, that we want as much freedom and creativity as possible consistent with the health of society as a whole, that's all he means by socialism. Now, if you think that that's an anodyne definition of socialism and that what socialism really means is communism, well, we're engaged in an argument about the meaning of words. We're engaged in a semantic debate. It's a semantic debate that you'll lose because, frankly, I think a lot of the people who are in this argument don't know very much about the history of ideas, and they don't realize, for instance, how many people were advocates of social democracy, the mixed economy, socialism of one form or another, and anti-communist, opposed to the idea of the collective ownership of the means of production. Practically every European socialist party, aside from the communist parties, were opposed to communism and opposed to the collective ownership of the means of production. And therefore, what these people are going to have to say is that all the social democratic parties really aren't socialist. If socialism just means real communism, then they can't be socialists, but yet they are. If you want to make this into an argument about semantics, if you want to make it into an argument about the legitimate use of the word socialism, they're going to lose that because socialism means more than communism. It means more than Marxism. And the communists, through socialists in the gulags too, and the socialists fought against communists as well. There are many political battles between these two positions because they're distinct positions, historically speaking.
It's interesting because where I live in the world, in the northeast of England, you could say that during we had the pit mining, the coal mining industry, which was heavily subsidized, and it was the unions were powerful, And it was hard and dirty work, but they got well paid for it. And when you get into the 80s, you get Margaret Thatcher coming in, who completely embraces neoliberalism with Reagan. And all of the Northeast and elsewhere, places like Wales and a little bit further down south, all these communities were completely reliant on the coal industry. And Thatcher just closed them all down, just cut all the funding. Like 90% of them were closed down within just a few years. And the reasoning behind that was that the state should not be paying. The state should not be keeping all of these communities afloat. Now, and because it wasn't in the economic interest of the state. And I think this opens up an interesting sort of part of this, because on the one hand, to take the situation on board, by the time the 80s, I mean, it was a case that they were a little bit sort of out of date. They were, and it's also the case that we started importing coal from Poland, you know, so it ended up, in if you're going to turn everything into the free market, you turn everything over to the free market and run it, which was the thing which came in the 80s, I mean, the 90s, then the coal mining industry of the Northeast was seen to be sort of this thing from a bygone era. And it was generally the case, just get rid of it as fast as possible. But the repercussions of that were catastrophic, because you ended up with 50 and 60% unemployed. And many of these places just never came back to life until you get Tony Blair in. They funnel a load of money in. But the very heart and soul of these communities would just collapse. It just bottomed out. You got alcoholism, you got violence and poverty, and they just became sink estates. And so the interesting thing there is, like, how exactly do you do it? Now, I think the third position would be to take a careful look at the future planning where's the coal industry going and all of this kind of thing. But it would certainly be to kind of wind this down in a way which didn't just destroy communities. And the point that I'm mainly getting to here is that you can see that if you're going to use just purely the logic of capital or of neoliberalism the way Thatcher did, there was no thought to the actual lived conditions. In fact, you had people of the time like Norman Tebbit saying, well, they'll just have to get on their bike and find work elsewhere. Okay, great, but what you're really talking about there is disintegrating settled communities and sort of sending them across the country according to a sort of a profit motive. Mm-hmm. So on the other hand, just to sort of play devil's advocate, on the other hand, you could make the point that, well, the time of the coal mines was long gone, so something had to change. And it's a difficult one, to be honest.
Well, the get on your bike and find a new job is the 1980s version of learn to code, right? And yeah, these people are heartless. And I do think you should have protectionist laws in place to make sure that you have full employment in your societies. And maybe simple protectionism would have been enough to keep those people mining coal, keep people building ships and things like that in Great Britain. Whereas globalizing it because it's cheaper that way, whatever, would have, you know, basically has led to the collapse of working class and middle class standards of living all over the white world. It's happened in the United States, it's happened in the UK and so forth. Direct state subsidies to certain things, well, you can question that. But things like protectionist policies and let's just say protectionism, tariffs to encourage people to use local products, right? Local coal, build local ships, things like that. That I think would be satisfactory. That's the way that these things should be done. Now, of course, some people can argue, well, you can't make everything on your own. And maybe it's better in some ways if we shift production around to other countries. But if you're going to do that, you're going to have to let these people down easily and slowly. And certainly not do this kind of economic shock therapy that Thatcher did, or just the hollowing out and, let's say, gutting of vast areas of the United States, which used to be industrial powerhouses, are now industrial wastelands because of globalization. The advocates of globalization, the free trade advocates, always talk about prices to consumers. And the trouble with prices to consumers is that we're more than just consumers. We're also citizens and members of a community. And we have to ask about the consequences of economic decisions to the community as a whole. And yeah, we can get cheaper shoes, but we can also get cheaper shoes at the price of putting our friends and neighbors out of business, putting them in the unemployment line, which causes social decline. And then those, when you price that in, those shoes aren't that much cheaper. So I do think that if you want to call it socialism or not, protectionism, mercantilism, we used to have a term mercantilism for protectionism. And the United States grew into a major global power with protectionist policies. We did not grow to be a global power with free trade. We grew very powerful with protectionism. And that's true of the British Empire as well. It grew to great power with protectionism, and it began liquidating itself with free trade. Of course, some people get very, very rich from free trade, but it's not good for society as a whole, and it's certainly not good for working people. Pox, do you have some thoughts on this?
Well, as I was listening to Morgoth talking about, you know, the 80s and Thatcherism and the times before that even, I was just reminded of something that I try and do, which is when this topic comes up, especially this topic of socialism, when it comes up, which is just to put myself in the position of a coal miner, of a factory worker in, you know, the Industrial Revolution. Because socialism was the zeitgeist of the late 19th century and then going into the 20th century. It was. Well, why was that then? Well, because you had such a major shift in lifestyle with the Industrial Revolution and the industrial economy, and all these people from the countryside and all these farmers now having to live in massive urban environments and working in these factories and working in the mines and chimney sweeps and all this stuff, and all of the exploitation that came with that. Well, eventually it causes a reaction. And the reaction is labor unions and economic theories based more on the rights of the worker and communism and things like that. And so that's, I think that it all comes down to people having knee-jerk reactions to terms that have been misunderstood or turned into boogeymen. And then on the other side, you have a faction that wants to be intellectual about it and kind of scoffs at anyone who, in their view, I suppose, still clings to such boomer cringe ideas like freedom, you know, and individual liberty. And then at the same time, you know, from their perspective, just like the socialists in the late 18th century, early 19th century, I'm sorry, late 19th century, early 20th century, tried to find a different path away from the exploitation and the greed and the robber barons and things like that. Nowadays, we're trying to find an alternative path leading away from big immigration, for example, the immigration industry that is destroying the demography of our countries, big pharma, big tech. We have to deal with these problems. And many people have identified a sort of nationalist, socialist, state-based solution to these problems of modern-day capitalism, I suppose you could say. And then what that position that they take, what that causes then is for others to feel, like I said earlier, a bit defensive, as if, well, you're blaming, you know, Northwestern European-style individual liberty and capitalism is at fault here. Well, no, that's wrong. It's the commies that are to blame, and you are rubbing shoulders with commies. So I think it's just it all boils down to a mess of people arguing past each other and strawmanning, but like I said, I think it just comes down to the context of the time you're in. You have to live in the world as it is and look for solutions to the problems as they exist. So I think it would be nice to return to a more rational and mature level of conversation about this topic.
Well, I would also say, just to sort of pivot to the other side a little bit, the kind of the pro-China arguments that I see, I find that's terrible. I think the look of it is terrible.
Yeah.
I think nobody...
I totally agree.
I get the idea is the Chinese state is based, you know, they don't mm-hmm. take any crap off anybody, and they will put the interests of the Chinese people first, regardless of what. Now, even if we yeah. consider that, there's a problem. There's a problem when you're going to say that China is a third positionist state. I'm not arguing that it isn't, but I'll tell you what the problem is. The problem is they have the most heavily surveyed population on it, except maybe like the modern day person who lives in London, but you know, it'll be up there. But basically they have a social credit system, and they've been able to do that with the technology that we have now. So it's there's too much of this idea of looking back with some nostalgia to more authoritarian movements of the 1930s, which were on the right. But the problem is when you translate that, this kind of thing, into the 2020s, it's very much like you're endorsing a social credit system, which the Chinese already have. And in the West, we can see that we're heading that way anyway because of these public-private partnerships. You look at the companies and the government are in bed together about surveilling all, everything you do, all of your data being mined. They're in, you know, all of these companies like Apple and Google, and they're pushing it further and further. And now my view of a third positionist state is far from the state actually doing that. The state should be there to prevent that happening in the first place. The state should be saying to, say, Apple or what is it, Vanguard, or the Peter Thiel thing, you take your intrusive technology and you get lost. That's not going to fly here. You don't right. do that. Instead, what happens is this framing where that's kind of quasi-justified for the greater good or something. And I find that is a because if you then go to the average white guy and you give him that pitch, do you want to live in the Chinese, so like a Chinese style system? It's based, it'll not be woke, you know, they're going to have masculine. Yeah, okay, that sounds fair enough. But do you want to be on a social credit system where your bank account gets shut down because you've left some litter on the street? Now, this it's a slippery slope.
For me,
can I just jump in for one second there? Because I just wanted to clarify. It's curious that it seems that I'm being a lot more sympathetic to a side that I'm usually not very sympathetic with. And I should say that when the debate between these two factions was about, you know, based China, I was firmly on the side of the people being skeptical of that take and saying, actually, no, China's not a model to follow. I personally think that the Chinese model would never work in with European countries because it doesn't match our biospirit, first and foremost. And I said earlier that, you know, I'm kind of ambivalent. I don't really get too personally invested on this, you know, socialism or capitalism debate. But when it came to the debate of, you know, based China versus the cringe West, I firmly side on the people who are saying, actually, no, the West is pretty good still compared to China. I would not want to live in China. It's not that based. It actually is quite dystopian. What are you doing praising it?
Yeah, China is an utterly dystopian hellhole. Yes, they do justify their highly interventionist government by reference to the common good. Is it really for the common good of the people? Does it really make the Chinese better off? Or is this just the way that totalitarians always talk? What China does is it makes the idea of the common good of society, and it makes the idea of the interventionist state into something that's revolting to healthy, rational people. If this is what an interventionist government is like, give me classical liberalism. That's what a lot of people reason. Mm-hmm. I am all for the state, and I am all for the common good. And I look at something like China, and I just think this is a dystopian, totalitarian hellhole, and it's not something that we should be praising. It gives the common good and it gives the interventionist state a bad name, and it feeds into the classical liberal reaction, which is, well, we can't.
Exactly.
We can't try and have a state that pursues the common good. What does that even mean? Let's just have a society where everybody pursues their private interests, and let's hope that it all works out. And we should never give enough power to the government to do that, because we'll have the Cultural Revolution and the Gulag. That's just a stupid argument as well, because classical liberalism doesn't work either, or the forms of liberalism that we have today don't work well either. We cannot have a functioning society without using state power for the common good of society. Liberalism as an ideology either denies that there is a common good, or denies that we can know it, or denies that the state can pursue it. And that the best we can do is hope that some invisible hand makes everything work out. Well, that's clearly false, and it leads to pathological, unworkable forms of society. So morally speaking, I agree with the premises of the people who are praising based China. I just don't think that China is particularly a good example of that. I think it's a dystopian, totalitarian hellhole filled with ant people, collectivist ant people, and run by hysterical cranks. And if you want to look at COVID, the world basically followed China on COVID policy. It followed a totalitarian, dystopian hellhole ruled by hysterics, and allowed that to dictate the policies that we followed in the rest of the world. And China has crippled itself and is crippling itself with lockdowns and things like that. But a lockdown is exactly the kind of thing you'd expect in a dystopian, totalitarian, hubristic society run by hysterical bureaucrats. They think, oh, we'll just press a button and make everybody stand still, right? It's crazy. The idea that you can do that and then you can just hit a button and society will start back up again. And no, we don't have to worry about the costs to people psychologically, or the fact that it's going to create chaos and make it almost impossible to get things started up again. That doesn't come into the picture. It's just this sort of hubris that these people had. And of course, what happened is there was a great deal of conscious Chinese propaganda and gaslighting that was directed at the West. You had people who were arguing in favor of the Chinese approach, claiming that, say, allowing the virus to run its course so that you get herd immunity was genocidal and evil, right? Or the idea that instead of quarantining everybody, why don't we just keep the people, quarantine the sick and keep the people who are highly vulnerable separated out? That was being just decried as genocidal. And so we allowed this sort of totalitarian mind virus of the Chinese lockdown system to spread in the West. And we didn't have a system that could resist that. Why did we not have a system that can resist that? Well, honestly, because of liberalism. What is one of the ways that you can define liberalism as a pathological system is because it denies that there's a common good of society, it also denies the necessity of having a person or a social stratum that can pursue the common good in an emergency, namely the sovereign, right? The guy who decides that this is a state of exception and this is what needs to be done and does it. We don't have that, really. We just have, you know, liberalism and these ideas of like separation of powers and checks and balances. It makes responsibility into like a hot potato that people just try and pass around, right? Everybody wants to benefit from the system, but nobody wants to take ultimate responsibility in a crisis. And so what happens is the system is just sort of, it's like a ship at sea with no captain. And the sea that it's in is sort of increasingly just the gaslighted hive mind that is existing on social media. And policies are made because of hysterias that exist on social media. And of course, the Chinese were gaslighting the West into accepting their model. And we didn't have anybody would say no. Now, there are these interesting leaks that Pox was commenting on just the other day in the UK, where these, was it WhatsApp discussions? Imagine the leaders of an advanced society having discussions on WhatsApp. There were WhatsApp discussions of the British leadership about the lockdowns and COVID. And you had people like Boris Johnson saying very, very sensible things, but for some reason, Boris Johnson didn't have the guts to just say no to the hysteria. And you wonder, why do we lack the people who can say no to these hysterical social trends? And it's not just COVID. It was also Black Lives Matter. It was defund the police. All of these things are obviously going to lead to catastrophic consequences if they're allowed to run amok. And yet nobody stepped forward and just said, this will not pass and I will take full responsibility. You can blame me for it, but this will not pass. We did not have a leader in the United States who, on the second night of the riots after the George Floyd thing, would send out cops to shoot the rioters down. Right, that's what needed to be done. Absolutely. If we had hails of bullets on the second night of rioting, that might have been the end of the rioting, and it would have saved hundreds of lives. It would have saved the livelihoods of many, many people. It would have saved many cities from being trashed. And it wasn't done because we didn't have a leader who wanted to take responsibility for that and felt immune from the consequences of doing that. And that's another thing that sovereigns have to have. They have to have immunity. Instead, we had this helpless, hapless buffoon, Trump, who was trying to run for re-election with the black vote. He wasn't going to call out the National Guard to shoot these people down. He was trying to placate them by whining about honor the name of George Floyd. You know, it was pathetic. So anyway, the China thing. Okay, again, this is my position. In terms of moral axioms, I agree with the people who are praising base China. Okay. I believe in the common good and I believe in state action for the common good. I just deny that what China is doing is legitimate and makes a better society. I think it makes a hellscape of a society. And that one of the worst things that happened to the West in the last 100 years was basically the mind virus of Chinese lockdowns sweeping through the West during the COVID hysteria. And I do not believe that when people in our sphere were fighting against this by embracing classical liberal rhetoric, all of a sudden, all these people who used to be, you know, white nationalists and wink, wink, nudge, nudge national socialists were suddenly on the media, on social media, talking about bodily autonomy and personal freedom and classical liberal stuff. That I thought was a terrible shift. They felt forced to it as a reaction to this stuff, but it was a terrible surrender of on important fundamental moral principles, political philosophical principles. I've seen a huge bit of backsliding towards classical liberalism, which is not a functional system or it's not a good position. And maybe that backsliding towards classical liberalism is now expressing itself with this sort of quasi-Austrian economics stuff that's now been injected into our sphere. I don't know. Morgoth, what are your thoughts on this? I know we disagree on some of these matters.
Well, in the case of the, I was heavily accused of being not just a classic liberal, but a libertarian. And if it was becoming very close to the British state, well, they were doing everything in their power to get those vaccines, which were untested, into everybody. And my general view on that was that avoid it at all costs. Avoid it no matter what you've got to do, and no matter what you want, whatever law, whatever's there, whatever argument you have, deploy it to avoid it. Because at the end of the day, my fundamental principle is that you have to take care of your own people, and how you do that, how that's to be achieved, is the first priority. What's downstream from that is the ways and the argument.
Right.
And the
right.
politics that you adopt. And that's always been central in my view. And I mean, since that this has came up, one of the things that I objected to was that what I saw was a widespread betrayal wherein ideology superseded the actual physical well-being of the folk. So,
right.
so an ideological or a principle, let's just say, for example, to move it away from the vaccines, because that's a sort of hot thing. The lockdowns in general, you could say, they weren't as deadly. They're not that dangerous. But just in theory, then I actually pivoted, because I went along with that at first. I kind of thought, okay, I get it, because the state, the argument was at the time, the state will have to make an exception, and it will have to put all of these corporations in place. It's going to have to sort of bitch slap Globo Homo in order to shut down borders and do what's needed to bring this thing under control. In actual fact, that the state was operating under NGO, under the guidance of various institutions and various multinationals and banking and hedge funds and all the rest of it, who all seem to be in on this for a big jamboree. And so, far from the state being in sovereign position, it was actually a lackey. Now, this changed everything, because then the third position stance on this became completely redundant and unhelpful, because that's how, and therefore they ended up basically shilling for Bill Gates and Pfizer.
And a lot of them were simply being paid to shill for it.
Well,
I mean, that's a part of the factor. And again, this goes to the corruption of liberalism. So many people in government positions take money from private enterprises and shill for them. And it's just pure corruption in any system where serving the common good is the purpose of people in office. You'd have to define this as corruption. But if you don't believe there's a common good or that it can be pursued by the state, well, what else do? You simply sell you sell policy to the highest bidder. And so, yeah, we were in a situation where we had multinational pharmaceutical giants that were basically dictating policy through bot spokesmen, because they wanted to cash in by pumping people's veins full of this untested and largely unnecessary sludge. It was just utterly appalling and completely contrary to any rational political system.
And so from my perspective, it was the first question, is this good for us or is this bad for us?
It's definitely bad for us.
You could do like a flow chart, you know, of how you make decisions and how you arrive at conclusions. There's a thing happening. It could be anything. There's a thing. We're confronted with an issue here. I ask them, is it good for us or is it bad for us? Now, in the particular case of the bodily sovereignty thing, what I had in mind was the 21-year-old girl who beautiful who lives up the road, and I was talking to her mother a lot, and she wanted to go on holiday, and I was trying to look for arguments how to convince her not to get this thing. And so the first question was the protection of our people. And so it was irrelevant to me what ideology that collided with, because the principle, I view nationalism as more of an existential thing than this kind of well mapped out ideology. And so the people who took umbrage with that were people who were like, well, hold on a minute. The arguments that you are putting forward here, they tend towards being liberal, you know, that they're boomer, they're this, they're that. And the framing that we have to be is that this is really based because we aren't liberals. And I thought that was bankrupt because at the end of the day, this was not good for the people. And so what happened was that the cart was put before the horse. First of all, you establish the what's good and what's not good for the people. And then you weave that into an ideological, so it's a coherent framework. What happened was that we had a template of an ideology with a certain set of bullet points. And then it was kind of like, well, sorry, but we're going to have to go along with this thing, because this is our ideology, and whether or not this is good for the people is kind of redundant. And I thought it was just a complete betrayal of all of the very way I view nationalism.
Absolutely. There are people in the nationalist sphere who aren't really nationalists. What they are is Nietzschean power worshippers. The worst example of this is a person who's departed from our sphere, namely Richard Spencer. He basically is not interested in the common good or white people. He's interested in power. And eventually he just dropped white nationalism entirely and is now basically shilling for the people who really have power, which is the establishment, which is our enemies. I think that that's pathological. Obviously, we are not simply worshipers of power. We believe that power can be unjust. Power is not necessarily a good thing. Power can be good or bad. It's not unconditionally good. It depends on the use that it's put to. The state is not unconditionally good. Depends on the use that it's put to. I applaud state power when, for instance, it's used to scare oligarchs and whip them into shape. I loved it when Ron DeSantis made Disney cry. We need the state to make big business afraid again. I wholly believe that. But I don't worship the state when it engages in reckless and destructive behavior and tyrannical behavior over the populace. And all too many people who are in our sphere do. And I think that that's a big problem. There are a lot of people who are power worshipers and state worshipers first, and only reluctantly or as an afterthought are really concerned with, is this good for the people? Which I think has got to be the first position.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember I used to get dragged in whenever Hope Not Hate, they don't do it anymore, but for a long time, Hope Not Hate would always bring up a blog post that I'd written, which was based on I would leave for work early in the morning. And there was a girl, she was cheeky, and she called my dog a rat. And she was like, I think she was about 14 or 15 years old. But she was, you know, she was a bit of a tomboy, and she was a bit mouthy, but she was a character. And I liked it that where I lived, she was still able to wander around the streets delivering newspapers at 7 o'clock in the morning, giving a bit of sass to a fella walking his dog before work. And I thought that deserves to be protected. And I got into on the Telegraph blogs where me and Millennial Wars used to hang out all the time years ago. And this came up, and I was saying at the end of the day, the migrants coming in, it was actually to do with cross-channel things what we had back then. They do not deserve to come in because I think that girl's safety comes first. That's it. That's it. That's as far as that's the argument. That's it. That's the principle. And they were saying, but they're going to keep coming. And I was saying, I would sink the boats. And then they kind of upped the ante. And they were saying, okay, so what happens when there's like 1,000 boats over the course of a month? You're going to blow them all up? And I was like, well, I think they'd get the message after like 20. But if it need be, but if need be, yes. And what they were trying to do was to kind of load the seesaw in a certain way. And it was kind of like, well, sooner or later, the safety of that cheeky girl with her newspaper around that surely that can't outweigh like what all the people in Africa who want to come to England. And I was like, well, yes, it does.
It does, absolutely.
It does. It's not a numbers game and like that. I'm not going to compromise on that.
They're not of equal value to us.
Yeah.
That's what nationalism ultimately boils down to, is the willingness to say, I'm sorry, I don't value all human life equally. I have a natural, normal, and entirely right preference for my own people, and I'm taking our side in these conflicts. And that means that, yes, I would happily allow a million Africans to suffer in Africa with a low standard of living and bad government, et cetera, rather than allow them to come to the United States or to England or any white country and make even minor inconveniences for my own people. That's just the way I look at it, because these people are not of equal value to me. I value my own first. That's natural. That's normal. That's right. And any kind of moral argument that tries to abstract away from that or sidestep it or deny it simply has to be rejected. It has to be confronted and rejected for what it is.
And the principle of that argument is the exact same one that I stood on when it came to the whole saga with the lockdowns and the vaccines and all of that.
Yeah.
So the reaction was different.
Yeah.
But, you know, never mind.
Pox, what are your thoughts? You've been quiet for a while. We've been talking over you.
Oh, no, I've just been transported back to like 2.5 years ago. It's been a trip down a memory lane, but not very good memories. Because I remember when this became the whole question of, should you adopt liberal positions to fight against a tyrannical state that's working against your interests? And this was all over Telegram. Frothy Midyard made some very good commentary about this. And, you know, I was COVID skeptic and vaccine hesitant, vaccine resistant, all those terms, primarily because I am aware of the fact that I live it during a time in which the vast majority of the, you know, Western governments are actively malevolent towards people like me and everyone else, pretty much, mm-hmm. but especially, you know, me and people like me. So why should I trust them when it comes to the motivations and the efficacy of putting us all under house arrest for 72 days or injecting things multiple times with rapid frequency, very short interludes in between injections? No, I'm going to be very skeptical because I know how much these regimes hate me, really. So in that context, yes, I think it was rhetorically valid and practically valid to rely on things like, you know, bodily sovereignty and the rights of the individual simply as a method to stave off, you know, as you were saying, the hysteria coming from COVID zero ideologues that were getting that idea from dystopian China,
right?
To stave them off. And then also as we were discussing dystopian China and cowards like Boris Johnson, who didn't want to follow that type of model, but ended up doing so anyway, despite these leaked messages showing that he was clearly aware of the fact that
he knew better.
Exactly. He knew that the highest risk people were over 80 years old. And even then, they were still only, you know, at a 94% survival rate. Oh, no, dear God. And he even says, you know, if I was a 85-year-old woman with the choice of wrecking the economy or, you know, rolling the dice with an illness that I have a 94% chance of surviving, I know which one I would choose. But he caved. And I think this is a reflection, you know, the cowardice of someone like Boris Johnson, and also the willingness for Western governments to follow the Chinese model. And then along with that, the online voices or, you know, nationalist voices who suddenly became very pro-China, very, very supportive of the Chinese model. I think this is reflective of something that Douglas Murray actually got right in his book, The Strange Death of Europe, in the chapter where he talks about how Europe lacks confidence in itself. I think it's a sign of our lack of confidence that rather than boldly pursuing the third option, right, the third force, the third alternative, we have people waving pom-poms for a Chinese system, which I said, as I said, you know, some time ago, it doesn't and wouldn't match our biospirit. Again, referencing the Austrian painter, he said that National Socialism comes from an ancient Germanic institution. He saw it as a continuation of the Germanic biospirit, the Germanic way of organizing society. And I think it's this looking to China or the cowardly way that our leaders pursued Chinese COVID zero policy type things and lockdowns and things like that just shows a lack of confidence in the European way of doing things, which is a shame. But then along with that, it is just the recognition that we are ruled by people who really don't have our best interests at heart. Talking about the folk, Morgoth mentioned the well-being of the folk. It's obvious. I'm not sure. I've thought about this many times. I'm not sure if there's any comparable moment in history where so many people were ruled by malevolent regimes, like regimes that are actively, visibly malevolent towards them.
Yeah.
When it comes to people like me and like you and Morgoth, it's really shocking. And so knowing that, of course I wasn't going to, follow their mandates on injections and multiple month lockdowns and things like that. I mean, it was just no way.
Yeah. So let's check and see if we have some questions here. Folks, if you want to send questions along with super chats, which do help us out, please do it through Entropy, or you can do it through DLive, or you can do it through Odyssey. So let me just thank a few people who have donated some DLive tokens. Slog has donated 14 lemons. Thank you. Norse Nature has donated 2 ice creams and 4 lemons. Appreciate that very much. Okay, we have a couple of questions that have come in at Entropy. Archie writes in with $5. Thank you very much. Is there an economic system that can work without importing immigrants to keep the economy growing? Making babies isn't an answer when land already is overtaxed. E. Michael Jones might have a point regarding the tensions between labor and usury. Is there an economic system that can work without importing immigrants to keep the economy growing? Yes. Why not have a non-growth model economy? The idea that the economy always has to keep growing strikes me as kind of nutty. Well, everybody personally would like to have more, I suppose. And so that seems to lead us to have a desire for increasing growth. But we have all these social programs that are Ponzi schemes, basically, that are based on people paying in to the system, paying taxes for pensions and things like that. And so people think that we have to have constant economic growth. Why not investigate different ways of financing pensions? Why not aim for a steady state economic system? Ultimately, I think that's what we have to do. One of the great things that's a pressure on this is the pension thing. And one of the weird things about contemporary economics is the idea that the state, which creates money, needs to tax citizens to pay for things, or, and this is even more astonishing, borrow the money that it can create from private citizens or banks, institutions, to fund the government. How is it the case that if the government actually can create the money, it needs to borrow to fund itself? How is it that if the state can create money, it needs to tax in order to fund itself? This idea of borrowing or taxing to fund the state goes back to the time when money was basically scarce, finite physical resources, shiny bits of metal that some people might have had, and therefore the state needed to borrow or tax to get a hold of it. But we don't live in that world anymore. We live in a world of fiat currencies, which are basically just created by fiat. That's what it means. Let there be $1 trillion. So if the state can create trillions of dollars, and it has been doing that quite a lot recently, why does it need to borrow and why does it need to tax? If you can come up with a model for state financing without borrowing and taxing, that is one of the ways I think that we could get outside this constant pressure to have economic growth for taxes, right? For pensions and so forth. And really, it's the pension system in a lot of these countries that is one of the great driving forces for the open borders arguments. And E. Michael Jones, you mentioned, recently put out a comment on social media, maybe it was Twitter, saying that Japan is facing a crisis. They have too few people paying taxes in for these old pensioners. First thing they need to do is import Filipinos. And then in the long term, the solution is to become Catholic. It's just craziness, right? But it's his cranky Catholic spin on the craziness that's sort of baked in to the welfare state system. But underlying that is, I think, a real question about why do you need taxation or borrowing to fund state projects if the state is the creator of money? Anyway, those are my thoughts. Pox, do you have any thoughts on this question?
Yeah, I pretty much agree with what you just said there. It is based on pyramid scheme models where you have to have constant growth as the justification for, you know, an ever-increasing population of imported people. The E. Michael Jones solution to the fact that there are four times as many Japanese people on that island than ever in history. So apparently that's a demographic crisis. You know, the people who see that as a crisis fall into two camps. And E. Michael Jones in his tweet fell into the camp that this low fertility rate is a crisis because, you know, it's not good for the line go up, right? And so what's the solution? Well, you need to import Filipinos and then convert to Catholicism. Well, then that's not Japan anymore. And it's also that the welfare economy, which you, yes, you described, you know, the pensions, the welfare economy, the housing market, and the consumer economy can all be maintained and increased. And so I think that if that is the economic model that necessitates growth, that's a really bad model. If we need to find an alternative model to go on. So I agree with everything you said there.
Morgoth, what are your thoughts on Archie's question?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I think we've done well as far as the memes are to make a meme of this obsession of the elites with the line going up on the graph. Like, no matter what happens, the line has to go up on the graph, which is what it amounts to. And it's completely insane. I just find it completely unhinged. And what you notice is that everything, it becomes sort of subservient to the economy. It's no longer asked, like, what is a fundamental question, like, what is actually the purpose of the economy? What is it for? What does it do? Or instead, everything, whether it's the make, the demographics, the ethnic makeup, all of that, everything will be subservient to making the line on the graph go up. It's absolute madness, and it doesn't make for a very good life. But one of the curious things, because we've been sort of, you know, playing backwards and forwards with a bit of the Marxist versus capitalist. The interesting thing is that if you look at the sort of typical Tory, and I know it'll be the same with the American equivalent and the Republicans or whatever, is that their justification for the economy will be like these purely kind of material benefits, and the end of like something which is kind of weirdly Marxist, because it's all, well, everybody's going to have more stuff. Nobody will have any kind of feeling of home or hearth. Nobody will have any kinship or connection to those like them around. That doesn't matter. That's hate. Instead, you've got to think of all the things you can buy. You've got to think of all these material goodies. You know, it's just this pure kind of junk. And I remember, because we're going to move on to Ireland, where I've had a bit of an adventure over the last week. And there's an Irish writer and thinker called John Waters, who are quite like, I always like to hear him and read him. And he actually wrote a book about Ireland, and he called it Give Us Back the Bad Roads. And I thought that was like a beautiful snub to what they'd been doing to Ireland, because it was kind of like, Ireland was fine. Ireland was fine in the 80s and 90s. It had its issues, okay. But it was a settled people with the traditional values. They felt they were in their own skin. And unlike all of the other countries where it was more like this drip, drip, drip of poison over the years, in Ireland, they kind of just rammed it all down their throats. And John Waters had sort of taken a look at these changes which have taken place in Ireland over the last 10 or 15 years. And the title of the book says it all. It's as if to say, we've seen what you're offering, and we'd prefer just to have the old roads. We'd prefer just the way things were. We understand what it is. We understand what's on offer here. We don't want it, though. And that's quite poetic.
Yeah, I had a conversation a couple of months ago about gypsies, and it suddenly occurred to me, one definition of what's sacred is what you never give up, what you would never give up. And the gypsies, they wandered sometime in the Middle Ages out of India. They were one of these tribes in India that lives by begging and stealing, and there are thousands of them. And they left India. And they got all the way to Europe, and they multiplied, and they gave up their religion. They gave up their language. Those things weren't sacred to them. What was sacred to them? Stealing and begging. That was the one thing they didn't give up. Everything else they discarded, but they kept stealing and begging as a way of life. That was the sacred thing to them. The sacred is what you don't give up. And what we have with these kinds of arguments is an idolatry of the economy. The economy is sacred. The economy has to be preserved. The big line has to go up, even if at the end of the day, the Japanese people are destroyed. At least the Japanese economy will still be humming away somehow, and the big line will still be going up. Yes, the island will be filled with Filipinos. Yes, there'll be Catholics. Yes, There will be no Japanese anymore, but there will be a Japanese economy. That's insanity. What's sacred, what should be sacred to the Japanese, and what is sacred to most Japanese, is persisting in their way of life and in their identity as a people. That should be the sacred thing for every people, and the economy needs to be subordinated to it. The Austrian painter that Pox mentioned earlier called that socialism, right? Subordinating economic life to what's truly sacred, which is the people and its propagation over time. That is how I think that identitarians view economics. We think that, yeah, freedom is a nice thing and having nice stuff is good, and equality, that's a good thing too. I like equality, but none of these things are more important than persisting as ourselves into the future, preserving our identity. That comes first. That's sacred. All these other things are relative to that. We can cut and trim these other things, but we can't compromise on what's sacred, which is our identity. And you know, the idolatry of the economic system has to be denounced exactly as that. It's an absurdity. What's the purpose of the economy? The purpose of the economy is to organize a people's material lives, right? Production, trade, things like that. Why? So that a people can flourish on this planet. And if it gets out of control and becomes a threat to the people who created it, that's the very definition of a rogue institution, of an institution that's become a cancer. And it has to be scaled back. And scaling it back is one thing that people have called socialism, historically speaking. I would call it the mixed economy. I would call it putting the common good above individual interests. There are lots of things you can call it. I could call it classical political philosophy. But as long as we're clear about what's going on, that there are certain things that have to be held sacred, which is the common good of a people, a distinct people, and the other stuff has to be sacrificed, trimmed around the edges, put in its place to serve the common good, then I think that we've arrived at the third position.
Yeah, I agree. Rishi Sunak made a memorable one just the weekend there. There's some new deal because of Brexit, they've got all of these issues regarding the Northern Ireland and the Irish Republic, because the Republic's in the European Union and the Northern part isn't. And it's like, where exactly do we put the border? It's this headache. And the new kind of chapter in the saga is that the Northern Ireland will be allowed to have both the British market and the European Union market. And Rishi Sunak, like, he literally referred to Northern Ireland as like an exciting economic zone. And I just thought, well, if not to romanticize all the troubles there, even you can fully take on all of the blood, all of the blood feuds, all of the problems that we've had over the years. They're not pretty. It's who is to blame, who isn't. This goes on and on and on, but it is a thing, you know. It is, and then to have that reduced, to have all of those broken hearts and bones, and bombs, and that all that history, and then to now turn around and just call it an exciting economic zone. I just thought that was so disgusting. It's not that's not the place. It's more than that. It's far more than that. They're ghastly, ghastly people.
Yeah,
it just strikes me as only a culture and a society governed by bankers and merchants could behave like this, could think like this. It is shocking. It is nauseating. it really is.
Well, if you look at classical liberal economics and libertarian ideology, none of that stuff matters. None of that stuff should matter. It doesn't matter to them, and this is why their ideology doesn't matter to me, because I put identity first. And like I said, I think having nice things is good, but I would prefer to give up a few nice things or to pay higher prices for them to preserve my nation and my people. Most people feel that way. And if you want to call that socialism, fine. I would call it the mixed economy. I would call it common sense. I would call it nationalism, putting the nation first. We have a couple questions. Actually, quite a few have been pouring in. Folks are getting excited. They're liking this conversation. So let's go and see the Odyssey questions. Gadius wrote in with $5. Thank you. When Keith is railing against or Howe is singing the praises of capitalism, they both miss the point, in my opinion. They're essentially accepting the Marxist framing. Why concede the language in the first place? The concept of capitalism comes from the same place as the racism concept. What do you think, gents? Well, personally, I would agree to the extent that capitalism is being used in a Marxist sense, then we shouldn't be arguing about that. We should be setting the terms of the debate. As nationalists, the nation and the people come first, and those are the terms of the debate in which economic things should be placed. We need to frame this debate rather than accept frames from outside. Pox, do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think that's well said, and I always appreciate Gadius's ability to keep his eye on the ball, and he's very good at escaping frameworks of our adversaries, and I think this is one of them. So definitely.
What about you, Morgoth? Do you have any thoughts on this?
What was the question again?
Is this debate about capitalism essentially missing the point because they're adopting a Marxist framework for talking about the economy?
Well, yeah, I don't like that framework, but I remember I had a sort of back and forth with somebody recently, and they kind of lent into this, and it was somebody from that kind of scene. And the point they were making was that basically in the last 15 or 20 years or so, there is this downward trend in the material conditions of white people, which is probably true. I mean, the people can't, young millennials, they can't afford to get on the housing market and all of that. But these are kind of mainstream kind of talking points. I would actually take the point that people are kind of a bit too flabby and a bit too comfortable and a bit too lax, and it's as if they're being sedated by all of this stuff, because at the end of the day, you can be perfectly comfortable in if the argument is just about material conditions. I find it kind of reductionist, because what you end up with is you'll get a reply, the kind of you'll own nothing and you'll be happy kind of reply, because what's implied with that kind of meme is that you won't actually be, you're not going to be in poverty. It's just that the technology and everything will have reached such a place that all your needs are catered to and taken care of in this new sort of digitized future. Now, that's a problem. If you're going to kind of rely on an argument, which is that, well, the material conditions of whites are deteriorating, and therefore that needs to sort of be part of our platform, I'd be wary of that, because the solution is already on the way. And in fact, I would prefer to have a more fundamental like sort of take on it and say, do we really need all this stuff? Do we really want to live in this way where we're arguing over beans? Because no, I mean, I've got to be careful here, because people, it is here, you know, in a way I'm kind of undercutting my own argument, because things are deteriorating rapidly. People in England, people can't afford to put their heating on. So these more, for the first time maybe in many years, people are facing material hardships. They're on the way now. People can't put their heating on. People are struggling with inflation. So in that sense, we are arriving here. But on the other side of that, I'm kind of cautious, because I'm well aware that there's a problem with people being so comfortable, where they're just kind of glued at screens all day and leading sedentary lives and a sort of in a fantasy world. There's a that side of it as well.
So I have another question here. This comes from Archie again. And Archie asks to Morgoth, any concerns or insights about the trade and customs deal between Ireland and the EU that Sunak and von der Leyen announced? A journalist asked Sunak why none of his predecessors were able to solve the problem. His answer was evasive. So any further thoughts about this?
It seems to me that, I mean, I spoke to a few people in Ireland, and it seems to me that they're getting ready to throw the North under the bus for whatever reason. And I think the reason for that is because the elites view it as being largely a redundant problem. It's an old problem, because, and this is kind of what we've been getting at, if everything is just an economic zone, then the old problems with Protestants and Catholics in the North, that sort of little enclave in the North, which is represented by the DUP now, this becomes a problem. I think for a long time, when it was more sort of from a perspective of the British as a power, for the city of London, they, for one reason or another, they liked having that little place on the North. They didn't give it up. And now it looks like they're kind of thinking, well, at the end of the day, if everything is just an economic zone. Why do we still need this? And I think that the DUP is the last I heard, actually starting to hint towards there could be violence because of this. Well, I don't know whether that violence would be directed towards the City of London or whether it would be directed. I don't know. I don't know how that would, you know, and I'll put it in, which I wouldn't support, where that would go. But they could well take a stab in the back from London. But that's kind of how I see that going, where there's going to be this transition into, as Rishi Sunak said, it's just an economic zone. And so the entire kind of borders and the place itself will become, its identity will be less pronounced and less focused on, and it will instead be just about economics and who will care. And there may be what they would view as a few reactionaries up there who have to be dealt with, but by and large, it's kind of like a bygone era. They want rid of all these old grudges.
Well, Rishi Sunak, I don't believe, is a Protestant. And I don't believe that the existence of a Protestant enclave in Ireland really matters to him. He is a globalist and an oligarch. And as England becomes less and less of a Protestant nation, these issues become less salient. So yeah, why worry about Northern Ireland if religion and identity, all these markers of identity, don't matter anymore? Why even care about it? That's a good point. We got a $5 donation from Confederate Patriot. Lol, we invented capitalism. I don't know which we this is. Your World War II model adherence to National Socialism is quaint but absurd. I like y'all, and this is a good conversation, but your economics are way off. The trajectory of mankind is towards more autonomy and less control, self-reliance, not state dependence. Well,
that's a hopeful view for the trajectory of mankind.
Yeah. And I think this guy is maybe he's a Confederate around Auburn, Alabama. Maybe you're imbibing Austrian economics or something like that. It's certainly not the model that I think the Confederacy actually had. But anyway, yeah. Do you have any thoughts on this, Morgoth?
Well, I would say the problem is, in a globalized world, you're going to need the state to guarantee your autonomy and freedom from the forces that which are at large. You're going to need the state to act as a kind of umbrella to protect you from all those intrusive digital companies and corporations which are out there after you.
There are corporations that are bigger than many governments, many nations, and more powerful. Yeah. And to talk about self-reliance, not state dependence, that turns into an apology for basically allowing corporations to metastasize to the point where they dictate policy and where states are incapable of reining them in. And that's freedom from your point of view, Confederate Patriot, or the point of view of people who talk like you. I don't want to foist ideas on you that you don't actually hold, but there are people who talk like you who think it's perfectly okay to live in a world where corporations are more powerful than nations and dictate policy to states rather than states having the power to make corporations afraid. I want to live in a world where we have a state that is governed by people who are putting identity first, who treat the people as sacred and the common good of the people as sacred, and are willing to make oligarchs afraid of the state. We need to go back to a system where oligarchs are afraid of the state. I never in a million years, when I was a libertarian, did I think I would ever utter sentences like that in the future. But that's how my views have evolved. I used to be a libertarian. I used to talk like you, Confederate Patriot. But there are more important things than liberty and equality. And that's identity.
I mean, just last week, I traveled from by car from Belfast all the way across the north towards the west, and then down into Sligo. And then I went further down south into just to a place called Castlebar and a few scenic places on the coast as well. It was quite a bit. I'm mainly in the northern part, but it was quite a bit. Now, what I wanted to get to was that coming from England, what I was blown away by was to travel across the Irish countryside. And, you know, from maybe it's different in, I'm sure it's different around Dublin. That's fair enough. But what I saw was mile after mile after mile after mile of small cottages, small villages, detached cottages dotted around on the landscape, halfway up a hillside. And I could, because if a cottage like that in England would cost $500,000, and yet in Ireland it seemed to be the norm. And yes, there were some obviously there were some towns, and the houses, they were kind of like council houses. Now, what that's left over from is a period of Ireland before the sort of global homo got its claws into it. That the Ireland existed like that for a long, long, long time. Now, if you take from the time that they got independence, when they were kind of like this forgotten about introverted country, you know, in the Atlantic, and they had that long kind of stretch of time where they were a settled people in their own skin. And mainly because they had a kind of inwards looking and kind of protectionist state. Now, here's the thing. The people there in those cottages, they've got space. They had healthy families. They were happy. They everybody knew everybody. It was a good life. And that was there because they didn't sign up into the neoliberal program and hyper-capitalism and the corporations until very late. They had to be dragged kicking and screaming onto it. So I don't buy this argument that it's like, well, if you've got a protectionist state, everybody's watching their back and the states are giving handouts left, right and center. It actually isn't. They just need to keep a few things in order and people are quite happy to get on with their lives. You can see it in the land and then the makeup. Now, what happens is once you get the corporations with a foot in the door, they begin buying up the land. They want more people, more houses going up, more construction companies going up. This is where it leads. And where you're going to end up is a kind of chipped and digitized, surveyed population, which is the exact opposite, which will be in cahoots with the state, which the corporations have bought. There's no way around the fact that if you want to have a degree of freedom in the 21st century, the state needs to provide it. We're not there now because they've all been bought out, but that's what I see coming.
That's well said. Pox, do you have some thoughts on this?
No, I think Morgoth just summed it up perfectly there.
Archie sends a $1 donation. Thank you very much. Who wrote and where is the essay about the different cultural adaptations to envy? I'm not sure what she's referring to. Guys, do you know what he might be referring to?
To envy? Oh, no,
envy?
I don't know.
The selfish gene? I don't know.
Well, I know F. Roger Devlin a couple years ago at AMREN gave a talk about anti-whiteness and envy. That might be the thing he's thinking of, but I'm honestly drawing a blank on that. Over at Odyssey, a White Capability writes in, I just wanted to say that some of us out here would love to donate, but have no funds. My kid just moved back in with me and I was already broke. I love these streams and I will help when I can. I did just get the White Nationalist Manifesto as a gift and I'm reading it now. Thanks, Greg. Well, thank you. That's music to my ears. And yeah, people give what they can give. If you can't give, you can't give, but I very much appreciate you listening in and reading the book, especially reading the book and passing it on. I wish more people would read that book. I wish more influencers would read that book. I wish we had a movement where people regarded it less as entertainment, less as a business, less as a social scene, and more as a serious metapolitical and political movement where attempts to lay out good fundamental arguments for our viewpoint would be required reading and people would debate this stuff. And and talk about it. I wish we had more of that going on. I wish there were more podcasters who were in that spirit. ABC writes in with 10 US dollars. Thank you very much. In what sense does the anti-white globalist woke establishment represent the global left? The Chinese, North Koreans, or Vietnamese communists do not try to replace their own people with foreigners or push LGBTQ agendas onto their children. Are we talking about a fifth column in the West? I guess that's an interesting question. In what sense is the anti-white globalist woke establishment leftist? Because you do find that in some left-wing or even communist societies, they don't have these crazy policies. The Chinese, as far as I know, are not trying to replace their people with foreigners. They're trying to replace foreigners with Chinese. North Korea, same thing. They're not trying to replace their own people. Vietnam, I don't know much about the place, honestly. There is something astonishingly evil about race replacement, about the Great Replacement. If you look at Plato and Aristotle, they had taxonomies of bad regimes in the Republic, or by Plato or Aristotle's Politics. They have classifications of good and bad regimes. They never in a million years could have conceived of a regime that's so bad that it is replacing its population with foreigners. Although both of them recognize that one of the marks of tyranny is that tyrants will surround themselves with foreign mercenaries. That's the closest thing. But they never dreamed of systems so evil that they would institute race replacement and inflict it upon their own people. And in a sense, maybe you're right. There's a external force here, a fifth column. Some of the people who are pushing this do not think they are replacing, quote unquote, their own people. They don't regard Americans or the British or the Italians or the Spanish as their people. Some of these people are just rootless cosmopolitans who have seceded from any nation state. And some of them have different, very strong tribal identities. But in some cases, yeah, we are talking about people who are not part of our own tribes who are imposing race replacement on us. The shocking thing is that there are people who are definitely part of our own tribes, people who might be even members of our own families, who have enrolled in this agenda. They might not understand it as race replacement explicitly, but when you confront them with the fact that it's race replacement, they don't immediately drop it. They come up with rationalizations, or they accuse you of things, right? So it's a really interesting question. Why don't we ask Pox, do you have any thoughts on this? To what extent is our anti-white globalist Western establishment leftist? Well, for one thing, before you go into that, it's not just the left, it's also the right. It's the establishment position that's committed to these evil ideas.
Yeah, that's what I was actually going to start off with. It's that, you know, these terms left and right are very difficult to apply nowadays, because even the right, what does that mean? I've just seen today that the Italian Minister of Agriculture, who is a member of Fratelli d'Italia, which is, according to the left, according to the mainstream media, is a far-right neo-fascist party. And yet the Minister of Agriculture of this, you know, supposedly far-right neo-fascist party is proudly boasting about how they have a plan to let in 500,000 migrants legally. So it's all fine. Tutto bene. As long as they come in legally, it's all fine. So the invasion of Italy will still continue, but hey, don't worry, they're coming in legally now. And he even said, we are not against waves of immigration. We're only against illegal immigration, which is your standard suicidal civic nationalist position. Mm-hmm. And yet this is a far-right party in 21st century politics. So where does the sense come in even using these terms left and right? Although, that said, I would say that it's still appropriate to say that the left is about these things. I remember seeing a very good meme about this, but it was basically, if everyone considers themselves on the left has embraced transgenderism, trans kids, open borders, replacement migration, that sort of thing. Well, then, because those are being promoted by people who identify as on the left, then that is a leftist position. And you can't weasel your way out and say, well, the genuine left doesn't approve of that. It's like how we have to make caveats for old school communists. You and I, Greg, were talking about this privately some time ago about how there are some old school leftists, like old school communists in Hungary, who are more opposed to immigration than Viktor Orban.
Yeah.
Because they're old school leftists. They're old school communists who want to put the working class Hungarians first. Now, clearly that does not reflect the modern left. So there is a disconnect with these terms, absolutely. But I think it's still fair, I suppose, to use the term as a shorthand, the left in the West, because the leftist parties, all of them pretty much throughout Europe and the United States, Canada, and Australia, have adopted these things as their cause du jour, as their fundamental platforms and ideas. So if the shoe fits, I guess.
Yeah, and beyond that, they are the vanguard that are dragging the center and the quote-unquote right behind them into these ideas. So it makes sense to say that, first of all, these are leftist ideas because leftists are definitely all over them. But also, the left is instrumental in dragging the whole of the political spectrum behind them into these bad ideas.
Right, exactly. It's exactly why the far right nowadays is, bog standard civic nationalism, because they've been so pulled far to the left that, even the center looks like it's far right, which that's a pretty, medium tiered take. It's not a big brain observation. It's just a fact. And it's always so funny to see when like libtards on Twitter post the opposite and they think that, oh, we've been pulled so far to the right that Bernie Sanders looks like an extreme leftist, and that's why he doesn't get the Democratic nomination. It's like, what planet are you on? We have been so pulled to the left, not to the right, if only.
Yeah, that's great. Morgoth, do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, this is another one of the kind of the big subjects that people like to. It's kind of related to the main theme of the stream tonight. But I remember there's a. In another sort of area of our thing, Academic Agent and Mencius Moldbug have been having a back and forth over this subject, wherein I don't want to mischaracterize what anybody said, but basically Academic Agent was saying the question is who's calling the shots in all of this. And Academic Agent's view was that if eventually you're going to have to go to a company like BlackRock, there's others, what he called the octopus, but you can use BlackRock as a good stand-in for this network of giant financial centers with a hell of a lot of power. And the reasoning behind that would be that they implement these ESG ratings on other companies. So a Hollywood studio or a corporation, if they don't go woke, they will be punished. Google may drop them a page or two, or if they're a smaller fish, of course, it will be easier to do. Or they may find that their shares on Wall Street get tinkered with, they get downrated. So it's as if there's this way, this super weapon, like a Death Star, which can terrify all of these, essentially to make them all compliant towards this agenda. And of course, with BlackRock in particular being fingered for this with Larry Fink, because obviously people will be thinking about people with small hats. Of course, Larry Fink with a very similar background to Moldbug himself. But Moldbug's sort of counterpoint to this, I did actually think this was an interesting thought experiment. And he said it isn't. Basically, he said money doesn't actually have power. What would happen if BlackRock decided they were Nazis and the ESG ratings would be sort of national socialist type policies instead of the woke stuff? And in his view, It's a priestly class based in Harvard and in academia. And then a little bit lower down the line, you'd have maybe the New York Times or whoever it happens to be. But the point is, it's not actually the money power. It's the priestly class. It's the intellectuals who are finally calling the shots and influencing all of this. And I'm gonna have to say, I'm not too sure which way to go on that. It's something that I'm still kind of processing, thinking through myself. I mean, I'll throw it back to you two. What would you say about all of that?
Well, I come down on the mold bug side. I haven't been following this debate. I sort of tuned Academic Agent out a long time ago, and I'm not on Twitter if that's where this is happening. So, but if BlackRock decided that they were going to be Trumpians, let's not say Nazis, just Trumpians.
Yeah.
What would happen to them? They would see capital fleeing their company, right? People would bail out. Why? Because what's motivating people are ideas, ideals, values. And this goes back to a lot of back and forth between Thuletide's camp and the quasi-Marxoid camp too. There are people who say wokeness is being pushed by capitalism. I don't think that's true. I think that's fundamentally false. What's going on is you have the dominance of leftist ideas, which are propagated through academia and the culture at large. And because these ideas are so dominant, what you have is people in business will seize on these things as basically a cloak or as a tool. They wrap themselves in the cloak of sanctity by saying, we're for diversity. We're green, right? I remember Zizek had a comment where I think he was in a Starbucks and he was pointing out all the sort of woke, politically correct stuff, you know, in Starbucks. And he said, in the past, people felt that they had to fight against capitalism to produce progress. And now, all we have to do is buy products and we can be progressive, right? Because the products are cloaked in leftist virtues now, leftist virtue signaling. And this is the way that human psychology works. With any dominant system of morals, you will find that people who are essentially amoral and self-interested will use those moral tokens as tools of advancement. That's what's going on with BlackRock, with Schultz. I know you can make all kinds of arguments about the ethnicity of these people like Schultz at Starbucks and Fink at BlackRock and so on and so forth. But ultimately what these people are essentially amoral, predatory, get-rich-quick schemers. And they are simply adopting the dominant ideology as a way of cloaking their crap in virtue. And that is why corporations go woke. And if Christianity were the dominant value system in society, they would all be pious. And there was a time when corporations were all pious, right? They would signal their love of Christmas and Christian virtues and things like that, because that was the dominant value system. So the idea that somehow capitalism is behind wokeness, that's just a quasi-Marxist horseshit that our people should not be foolish enough to be repeating. I think that ultimately what's dominant here are values and simply the corporations and individuals too, who are essentially motivated by upward mobility concerns and use these things as tools to virtue signal. So I think that mold bug is more correct on this issue, just as you've stated it, because I haven't actually followed the discussion. Pox, do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, this is really interesting. And it also shows how often we like to put things into two sides. But here we have a situation where it looks like the framework is that it's a question between Machiavellians and true believers. And I quite like this topic as well, because it gets into a bit like of Judaic esotericism and things like that. So I think there are definitely true believers, and they tend to be Zionists and the anti-white puppets, I suppose, the anti-white leaders. So, for example, I would say that Yuval Noah Harari is a true believer. He has ideological motivations behind his actions, his ideas, what he wants to see for the future. I think the 1619 black woman in America, I think she's an ideologue. I think she's a true believer. But apart from that, I would suspect that the people running finance are, as you say, you know, predatory, motivated by financial gain, material success, and they're not entirely interested in any sort of ideology at all. They just care about making money, and they have seen where the zeitgeist is or was, and so they have invested in it and taken advantage of it. So, I mean, you have the woke stuff, and then you have, you know, the centuries, millennia long, you know, war on Amalek type thing.
Right.
So you have people who are, for example, interested in immigration as a means to wipe out Amalek. But then you also have people who are interested in immigration as a means to make money, like Serco in the United Kingdom. Okay, so that's really interesting. I've seen on Twitter, like libtards, the skin intellectual types, some of them were complaining about how their seminars on black voices are now completely empty, and no one will hire them to give more speeches on deconstructing whiteness anymore. It seems like in a time of a financial pinch, suddenly the investors are no longer interested in investing in bullshit like speeches or books on deconstructing whiteness. So that's an interesting development, and I think it reflects the opportunistic and predatory nature of the men in suits with money on Wall Street. But then you get politicians like Joe Biden, for example. To the extent that he is cognizant, I think he is Machiavellian. You know, the other day he said something like, "I might be a white boy, but I understand something, something or other." The fact that he plays on anti-whiteism, whereas, you know, if you compare him with the Joe Biden in the past, where he, you know, said he didn't want his kids to go to a jungle school, right? You know,
yeah.
He's clearly Machiavellian. He's clearly being opportunistic and looking at the anti-white cultural zeitgeist and using that to his advantage. But is he a true believer? Does he actually believe any of that stuff? Probably not. I don't think he's had in his 80s a big change of heart. You know, when you think about how difficult it is for people as they get older to change their minds on things, I don't suspect that Joe Biden has had a dramatic change of opinion. And now he's this, you know, Black Lives Matter, woke, anti-white crusader. No, he's being told to say these things, or he's saying these things because it's politically opportunistic. He's not a true believer, but I definitely think there are some true believers out there.
Yeah, true believers, sure, are the people who create the moral climate. They're the ones mm-hmm. who uphold the table of values. And I think that they are less found in places like boardrooms and more in academia, the media, and things like that. That's where they are. And they are more like a priestly caste than a business caste. Now, there are oligarchs who have principles, and some of those people can be really, really dangerous if they've got the wrong principles. And some of them can be really helpful if their hearts are in the right place. And I look at Elon Musk as somebody who's trying to make the world a bit better. And he's certainly better than Jack Dorsey and the woke hive mind that was running Twitter before. So you can't discount the importance of genuine convictions on the part of oligarchs, right? But generally, where the values are shaped in society is not business people. It's more like academia and the culture. And I think that that's simply correct. And that what happens is change in the intellectual realm, change in the realm of values leads politics and it leads business generally. And so this is really a debate between cultural idealism and cultural materialism, right? And the people who say, oh, capitalism is responsible for wokeness, is they're just repeating Marxism, Marxist materialist ideas that the superstructure of wokeness is created by the base, which is capitalism. And I'm sorry, folks, I don't take Marx seriously at all as an intellectual. He's like Descartes. Descartes is one of the few great philosophers who's read in the canon, who's wrong about everything. And Marx is wrong about everything. And I can't even take him as seriously as Descartes, because Descartes was dealing with deep questions, whereas Marx is very, very much a superficial political ideologue who has just stupid ideas like material conditions control history. That's just not true. It's never been true, and it's just a distortion of human nature, basically, to claim things like that. Morgoth, do you want to say something?
I was just going to chime in on a sort of interesting case in point. Would be, so last year Amazon made the sort of bastardization of Tolkien.
Yeah, I was thinking this too.
They made it woke, but the question, like, Amazon have people out there, they have all the resources in the world. Now, they could have gone to the Tolkien Society, they could say, give us your best artists, give us your best, most loyal Tolkien scholars, we're going to hire them, we're going to bring them in, and they are going to guide the writing teams, and that's what matters. Kind of like what Peter Jackson did, actually. Mm-hmm. And they could do that, but and they could have made an absolute ton of money. Everybody would have loved it. Everybody would have been on board. Instead, they made this travesty, absolute travesty, and it was hated across the board. And you think, where does that fit into this? Because I don't think they made a profit on it. If they did, they could have made a lot more of a profit on it. They sunk $1 billion into this thing.
They'll never make that money back.
And it was just butchered. So from purely the point of view of saying, well, they're in it to make the money, they're not making money, they're losing it. But they seem to be happy to lose money for the sake of being woke.
This is what's so interesting about the true believers versus the Machiavellian, financial investor type or opportunist, because they sunk $1 billion into it. But at the start, do you remember, Morgoth, that at the start, they had Tolkien scholars like Tom Shippey on board. They had a series in mind that would have been far more respectful to Tolkien and his legendarium than what it became. So when the first investment was made, it wasn't a woke pile of shit. It was actually something that had potential to be quite good and well received by the massive devotees of Tolkien. So it's interesting to see the reaction to that is now that Amazon, I think, is very disappointed with that series. Changes look to be like they're going to be made. And now with the news that Warner Brothers has signed some new contracts to make even more new Tolkien films, that Amazon series is screwed. It's absolutely screwed, because now they're going to be competing with actual cinematic new Tolkien adaptations. But then, of course, curiously, we do have examples of people failing up, of absolutely disastrous projects that you could see it being a disaster, still getting, investment from the supposedly not very ideological, just focused on the bottom line, men in suits on Wall Street types. So it is curious to observe how that happens. People like to say, go woke, get broke, or get woke, go broke, whatever it is. And that often doesn't happen, actually. People fail upwards. They go woke and they go broke, the film is a bust, it makes no box office, whatever, but there are no consequences. The next sequel of that movie comes out, the director of that shambles gets hired to make another Marvel film, and on it goes.
I think there's reasons why there's not consequences, which is to do with the sort of the managerial way that these giant corporations run these days. But what I wasn't aware of the sort of the hiring and the firing of Tom Shippey, because in that case, it seems to back up Greg's argument where Amazon went into that where they were kind of neutral. They just wanted to make a decent enough. Look, there was going to be more diversity in than what was in Peter Jackson's originals. I think that's taken as read. But nevertheless, they went in wanting, in theory, to. They didn't go into this. They didn't buy the rights with the intention of butchering Tolkien and making something which everybody hated. What happened was that the ideologues came in and hijacked the process and turned all garbage.
Exactly. Yeah,
This
the true
seems to back up.
believers
Yes,
took it
this.
hostage.
That seems to back up Greg's take on this thing.
Because
I
the
think
true
so.
believers want to, they have to, like, as the priestly caste they are, they have to evangelize, basically. They're like evangelical Christians that I have to evangelize at every opportunity. I grew up in an evangelical church, and we were often instructed, you know, when you meet a stranger, when you make a new friend on the playground, evangelize, evangelize. I think it will be interesting to see the reaction this year, because 2022 was a horrible year for Hollywood. They lost unbelievable amounts of money, and Disney as well, you know, being one of
Disney's
the
in a
major studios.
crisis. Yeah.
Just complete shambles going on in Hollywood. So it will be interesting to see if going forward they make some sort of correction to that and realizing why did they have such a horrible year, or if they will, you know, double down and triple down, and the ideologues will, you know, keep ruling the roost. It should be interesting to see what
And
happens.
costing them more billions. Yeah. The way that this happens is they have such huge legacy intellectual products that they can generate profits on, right? That they take that for granted. And so it takes a very, very long time for the bleeding edge of woke garbage to actually affect the corporate bottom line to the extent that there's a pushback from the money people. And again, the money people, they have to say things, well, I support diversity as much as anybody, right? They will speak in the language of the reigning pieties too, right? Because they feel they have to do that. Everyone's constrained. If they want to be mainstream and respectable, they have to speak in this language. But then they'll push back against it. I forget the name of the guy who's trying to basically push Disney back towards doing entertaining stuff. He's trying to do a corporate takeover of Disney to do this. But I'm sure everything he says is cloaked in that language as well. But there is a pushback coming, you know, once the corrections are forced upon them. But it takes a very long time for them to feel the pain because they have this enormous amount of, you know, like I said, legacy product generating huge amounts of income. And of course, with Amazon, it's the global marketplace in one company, right? So they can afford to lose $1 billion on some stupid project. And the other thing is, it's just the institutions don't work very well in our society. We have this sclerotic managerialism, this, you know, groupthink, this passing the buck, this lack of leadership, this lack of adults in any of there are no adults of any age, you know, in many institutions. And so these things will just drift from crisis to stupidity to new crisis to more stupidities before anybody can sort of summon up the will to stop it, right? Yeah,
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, because I dip into nerd YouTube quite a bit, and they were talking a while back that the new Indiana Jones movie, which is being produced, which, look, it should never have been made, and everybody was begging them not to do it. But they said the original ending was that Indiana Jones was going to go through some sort of weird time portal, and he was going to go back in time, and he was going to wake up sort of in the I don't know, like in the early night, and then like 1905 or whenever, and he was going to be like a young girl, and the idea was that the Indiana Jones as a sort of masculine male character was going to be retrofitted, and it was that was going to be kind of put into a different zone, and the real Indiana Jones would be, I don't know, like what, Irene Jones or something. But what they were doing was phasing out his character and re kind of saying that in reality he was a woman, and it got called back. The studio, in this particular instance, the final film, they kicked the release date about 6 months down the line, and they basically said, no, this is not happening. This is not what the ending's going to be. This is all made up. But like Nerd YouTube actually had looked at the filming schedules, and there was this frantic kind of reshooting kind of thing went on, and people, you know, Harrison Ford was being called back from his ranch in Montana or whatever, and they all had to do it all the way. but it's a sign. If it's true, I don't know, because the studio denied it. But it looks like they were going to actually try and do that, and then it was like, oh God, no.
A similar thing happened with some proposed Batwoman or Batgirl series that got canned because from hearing about it, just from, you know, photographs of what's on being done on set, it was a horror show. And so the reaction was so negative that the channel or the studio that was producing it just threw it in the bin straight away. And so I guess part of the explanation for why certain things play out the way they do could be because some of the stuff we do works. Hey, what do you know? Maybe some of the things that we do actually work.
And absolutely.
These podcasts that we do, the essays that we write, the articles that we share, and the gatekeeping we do, as you know, as far as like the Tolkien community is concerned, you know, the gatekeeping that they did to protect that intellectual property, that legendarium, and the times that, you know, we get our followers and our friends to bomb the comment section of, you know, CivNet YouTubers who are not quite there yet, and we say, look, everyone get in the comments here and let this YouTuber on, you know, Nerd YouTube, as Morgoth calls it, who has, you know, 100,000 or 700,000 subs on YouTube, get them to take that one final step further and realize, no, what's being done to the Lord of the Rings is anti-white. It doesn't matter. Don't just rest your laurels on, well, as long as they cast the best actor, I don't mind if an elf is black. No. Take the step further and recognize the sadistic anti-white intent behind the casting of black actors to play what I've always been in Tolkien's world. White elves. So I think that works. And we can sometimes, you know, pat ourselves on the back, lift our chins up and say, hey, we actually sometimes are making a difference.
I agree with that. Go ahead, Morgan.
There's an interesting thing happening on Nerd YouTube, because I think they have a much more cutthroat in terms of their content and the amount of videos they make and what they actually have to comment on. They've got much larger audiences than people in our thing do, but at the same time, what you'll find, I mean, we've kind of been discussing it tonight, where even though our scene is smaller, there people go off in all kinds of different directions, and you'll find that people are arguing about different things or writing about different things. That's not, Nerd YouTube can't really do that because they're kind of fixated on pop culture and the latest movies and series. And what I've noticed happening is that there's new ones pop up. And there's one called, I think he's called A Little Apostate. And he does this. He'll do take the latest Thelma or whatever it is, and he'll just destroy it and he'll tear it apart. But I do notice he's gay, but he is very reactionary, like, and he's very upper class in his mannerisms, and he comes across as a sort of upper class English reactionary from about 1930. But what I notice is that he is much more upfront in his brilliant analysis of the Amazon Tolkien stuff. He's much more upfront and blatant about the ethnic side of all of this. And he's the hot new thing because the person to his, like a bit left wing over, and there's some of them who are kind of where Sargon was in like 2015 or something. The problem is, like, that begins to be a little bit stale, and it's not our people who are kind of popping up, but it's just other people in their audience are thinking, well, okay, I get the criticism there, that's fine. But I'm going to make my own, I'm going to write my own video essay, and I'm going to point out why the ethnic, why elves can't be black. And I'm going to put it into, I'm not going to be offensive. I'm going to put it into a specific context and make it palatable and all of this. I'm not going to get banned from YouTube. But what you notice is this rightward drift where the next person who comes along and the person who is saying, well, I do, you know, I mean, not so long ago, they wouldn't even mention what they would do, just to use the Amazon Tolkien as an example, but it's on everything. What they would do would pick up on the feminism, and they did, because yeah, Galadriel absolutely was the sword swinging feminist, and you know, it was low hanging fruit. And what interested me when I was aware of what was coming was that I wrote about it somewhere or did a video, but I was interested in this because I thought, okay, there's going to be feminism in it, but there's also going to be black elves, and there's going to be race mixing, and you're going to have hobbits which are black. So if you're going to go after the feminism, okay, we get it, she's a girl boss, it's all been done, we're all tired of it. But there's these other things as well. And some of them will draw the line at the feminism. But now what you find is that there's new people and they're getting very big channels very quickly. And precisely because they will then talk about the Black Elf and the Black Hobbit. And what you find is that they've started out with a sort of classic liberal position. But the new people arriving on the block who are getting big audiences, they are the ones who are willing to go there. That little step further, it's very interesting to see that.
Yeah. When I would just say, Morgoth, I'm not sure if it's the little apostate, because I checked on YouTube, and the YouTuber who goes by the little apostate appears to be a very cute blonde.
I've heard, I know her.
Maybe it was the Critical Drinker. I think the Critical Drinker actually made a video about Rings of Power, where he actually did say the race swapping is wrong, and here's why. I was quite impressed with it that he went.
Yeah, I saw that too. You know, when Disney took over Star Wars, and the first movie was absolutely dreadful, but people went, you know, in droves to it. And it slowly, though, a lot of people realized, my God, we've been had. This is derivative. This is crap. By the time the second one came out, The Last Jedi, I think people were primed, not the vast audiences necessarily, but the online commentators, especially YouTubers, were primed by some of the discourse coming from our circles, right, that was critical of how derivative and cynical and PC it had gotten with the first J.J. Abrams one. When The Last Jedi came out, people flipped out at this, and there was a very strong pushback against it. I thought that was interesting. And I was following this because I was writing about it. And, you know, I've written a lot about the Star Wars stuff. And so I was following the online discussions. It was very interesting. Even people who didn't want to attack The Last Jedi too much felt the necessity of identifying how people felt about it, identifying the SJW anti-SJW critiques and things like that. And I thought that was very interesting. They were obviously being forced to acknowledge the kinds of criticisms that people like us were pioneering. Then when Solo came out, the Han Solo thing, there was an actual boycott that got going that tanked that movie and lost hundreds of millions of dollars for Disney. And I thought that was extremely impressive. And I thought that that was a sign that the kind of film criticism and the criticism of political correctness and feminism and, you know, wokeness in general in pop culture that was being pioneered by people like me as Trevor Lynch and Morgoth and others was having an effect on the mainstream. And I think that, you know, years have gone by. It's been more than 5 years since The Last Jedi. They put out a third terrible movie in that trilogy, by again directed by J.J. Abrams. They've had these series that have been more or less successful. Some of them are horribly PC on Disney. And I think that Disney's finally facing a reckoning. And a lot of it has to do with them completely pausing the Star Wars franchise and getting a lot of the fans angry. And if you look at the fan discourse about The Last Jedi and Solo and all the other stuff that's come since then, it's influenced by our way of thinking. I do think Pox is right. I do think this kind of discourse has had an effect. And we just need to, again, pat ourselves on the back and keep going because it does work. And what's happening here is an illustration that ideas are the fundamental force in history. Ideas are power, ultimately. Yes, the government opposes us. The corporations oppose us. They're pushing all the opposite things. But even though they have all the advantages, they've got billions of dollars, they control the propaganda apparatus, they control the police and the military and the mall cops. You know, the fact is that everything they say is based on lies and it leads to terrible consequences, you know, crime and mass rapes and also just shitty movies. And we on the margins have been pointing this out over and over. There are more and more of us. Our ideas are getting through. And because ideas are more powerful than armies and more powerful than corporations, it's slowly having an effect. And this is how we win. So, and this is why we do these kinds of discussions, because even though it sounds like three guys talking for now 2.5 hours about things like movies, it actually does change the world.
I just wanted to say that the channel I mentioned before is The Little Platoon. He's already up to 117,000 subscribers.
Platoon is a term from Edmund Burke. So that's a very clearly reactionary.
Nod. He really is. And this is the new generation of movie critic on YouTube, which I'm happy to see. I mean, I actually did. There was actually, I don't know if you watched it, Greg, Andor, the series, a Star Wars series, which got completely forgotten about. And there's no Sith in it. There's no, there's no the usual cliche. It's a long meditation on living in a police state. And I noticed, I did my own video essay on this at the beginning of the year on YouTube, and I noticed that movie critic YouTube were giving it a pass. And it was Christmas, so I had time on the holidays, and I watched it, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. It wasn't nearly as woke as the horrible other stuff that's been coming out. I thought it was fine. It depicts the Empire. There's none of the mysticism in it. It's purely the Empire as this bureaucratic Orwellian and kind of dystopia, basically, this authoritarian regime, and it focuses on the bureaucrats and the resistance. And I thought it was interesting because movie critic YouTube were giving it a pass, and they were giving it a pass because it wasn't as woke and it was better written, which I thought was okay, fine. But then I looked at the left side of YouTube, and what they were saying was that it's an anti-fascist. Andor is wonderful because it's anti-fascist.
Well, they would say that.
Yeah. And then I looked back at the nerd kind of YouTube who are more centrist. And I was like, you're going to have to up your game here. And so in my video essay, I talked about the politics surrounding movies on YouTube, and I was kind of putting across a point that at the end of the day, the world that we have in today is like Andor. It is dystopian. It is where you have these horrible bureaucrats persecuting people for thinking freely. But don't let the left have a pass. Don't let the left own that. They are that.
They are that, yeah.
They are that. And this is the way you have to approach this. And I pointed out, you know, there was one, he's like a big liberal progressive type with a channel called Just Right, quite intellectual. And he had a big thing in his thumbnail where it was, what was it, anti-fascism as art or something like that. And I was incensed because I thought, and when he did the YouTube title of anti-fascism, he blocked out the bit which said fascist because he knows that he'd be destroyed in the YouTube algorithm if he actually put that name in there. And so he understands that he's kind of bending the knee to a certain system. But the question that I raised is that, do these people go along with this because it's an ideal? Like, basically, how do they know they're not the bad guys? How do they know they aren't these bureaucrats, which they always lump in as fascists in this fiction?
Well, one of the things about leftists is they really do lack self-knowledge. They don't have that, are we the baddies moment that we would hope they would have. And it's amazing how they project, how they deflect. But there are some who are honest, and they end up going down the very, very small leftist to right pipeline. I don't think they're the people that we should be primarily focused on converting, because I don't think very many of them are open to reason. But there are a few, definitely. And again, I think a lot of the people in our sphere who are wrapped up in left-wing talking points and rehabilitating Marx and all this kind of stuff, a lot of that has to do with simply a mistaken idea that somehow the left is going to be an area where our movement will grow. Whereas the truth is that no, the people who voted for Donald Trump in America are where the growth is going to be for racial nationalism, but the people who voted for Bernie Sanders is not an area that we're going to see much growth from. And when you have entire podcast networks and political parties that now seem to be focused on somehow chasing, you know, sifting through and finding three or four racist Bernie bros, that's just a huge malinvestment of talent and money. That we have a few more questions here. $5 from Noticer in Chief. Great stream. Tensions between two marginalized groups in the UK seem to be on the rise, namely the traveling community and the urban youth. It will be interesting to sit back and see how this turns out. P.S. at Reed Johnson is doing a sterling job as usual. Thank you very much. Hinchfoot has sent $25. It's very generous. Thank you. Tip for the interesting discussion. Thanks. Well, thank you very much. And $1 more from Noticer in Chief, Morgoth's review. I think the guy you're thinking of is the Little Platoon. Yeah, okay, that's been corrected. To your point, I think he gets away with more because it's masked by his authoritative posh accent. The Little Apostate was a female content creator. Okay, we've got that settled. Thank you very much, though, for your donation and help. Guys, it's been more than 2.5 hours. I've thoroughly enjoyed this. We seem to have maintained our audience through the whole thing, but I don't want to stretch people's attention spans much further. So let's wrap up here. But this has been a great discussion, and let's just do this again soon, because I think we have good chemistry here and good conversations. So Morgoth, how do people follow your work?
Morgoth's review on YouTube and now on Twitter again for the time being. We'll see how that goes. And Morgoth's review on Substack. You can find everything that I do on Substack. It's my central hub. So yeah, that's it. My voice is really giving out now, so I'll catch you later, folks.
Okay, thank you so much. Pox, how do people follow your work?
Yeah, just that you say, it was a great conversation. Really enjoyed it as well. My central hub, I suppose, is Telegram, so you can find me there. And I'm also back on Twitter. You can find me at Pox on Pop is the handle for that. And I still have my YouTube channel, amazingly. So I'm still there. I use it for sort of special occasions when I do interviews or live streams of my own. They get uploaded there. And then, of course, I'm on Odyssey too.
Wonderful. Well, thank you both so much for coming. Thank you, all the people out there who have been listening and moderating and donating. Oh, wait, I just see three more things have popped up in entropy. So let me thank people and read these. Friedrich has written in with $10. Greetings. Excellent show on importing foreign workers. Do you think our educational system should indoctrinate people to do their own chores so that they would never hire a foreign maid or gardener or waiter or whatever? Thank you. Honestly, yes. One of the things that burns me up is when I'm in a Trader Joe's or something, or a store, and the person scans everything and rings it all up, and then the person who's buying it stands there while it's all being rung up, and then waits for the person to bag their groceries for them. Oh, please. This is just vile because, of course, it wastes my time standing in line. It wastes everybody else's time standing behind me. Can't you do your own bagging, right? I just despise this quasi-aristocratic prejudice against work that a lot of people have. And I think we should clean our own toilets. We should garden our own gardens. We should bag our own groceries, and we should stop being so hoity-toity because the cost of that, losing our countries, and we should just draw the line and not be that way. We
It
should.
is so funny that you've mentioned that sorry, this is some weird serendipity about the bagger at the grocery store. Because just the other day I was thinking about how I miss seeing them because they don't exist anymore in the supermarkets that at least that I've been, that I go to or that I see. And I was thinking about when I was a kid, you would used to go to a market and there would be the cashier and there would be the bagger, who is usually like some teenage kid, in high school. Just, trying to make some pocket money. And I swear to God, I just had this thought like a couple days ago. I was bagging up my own groceries and I just, as I was leaving the supermarket, I thought, it's strange. It's been years since I've seen a supermarket that has, those high school age kids bagging groceries. I kind of miss that. It's I don't know, it's just funny.
I personally, I just like doing my own bagging myself, and it just irritates the hell out of me that what happens is now, since they don't have a bagger who's bagging as the checker checks, they have to check all the groceries, and then the same person has to bag them, and everybody else has to wait. I just hate that. Karatakos has written in with $5. Thank you. Have any of you fine gentlemen seen this year's CPAC? Looks like the Repubs have slinked back to the status quo, progressivism on brakes. No, but we're going to get a report on that from Cyan Quinn of Countercurrents, who's at CPAC today and is going to give us her report soon enough. Anne Frank Rizzo, again, love your name. $5. Years ago, the SBC placed a book on the Jewish role in pornography in little free libraries throughout the US. Views on the Stormer aside, what are your thoughts on doing something similar with the White Nationalist Manifesto? It really deserves more public exposure. I love that idea. I will give you copies of the White Nationalist Manifesto at cost, just the cost of printing and shipping them to, if you put them in little libraries in your hometown. I think it's a great idea. I'll do the same with white identity politics. I'll send them to you at cost if you will distribute them that way. I want these things to circulate. I was in a particular town, actually, and I pulled up in front of a house that was painted purple, and it was obviously inhabited by hippies. And they had a kind of psychedelically colored little library out in front, and I dashed from the car to the little library and found a book inside. I think it was like A Wrinkle in Time or something. I made an attempt to find something to take, and I left a copy of the White Nationalist Manifesto, but there was no talk in the local news. No one was called out to talk about this hateful book being placed in the little libraries. But eventually people will start making a fuss about it if it gets noticed, which is great because that's the kind of publicity we want, right? The FBI will be called in to investigate these free books being passed out. Law enforcement officials will be interviewed by the local news and so on and so forth. And that's all good. I love that. So yeah, I will send it to you at cost, and Frank Rizzo, if you want to donate them to little libraries. And I will extend that offer to anybody out there who wants to do the same. So folks, thank you again so much. I got to run. Pox has got to run. We will be back next week, though, with another episode of Countercurrents Radio, and I'm really looking forward to it. Thank you.